Okay, go. We're going to talk right now. Let me get just fire this all up and get him on the line here.
Steve, we were getting a little carried away
Damian
with
Damian Kulash, who is the lead singer. Okay, go. Hey, there he is. Hey, Damian.
How are you?
I'm great.
Hi, Damian.
Thanks for joining us. Hi. We really appreciate it on Net at Night.
My pleasure.
Congratulations on your success. It's hard to believe it was 2005 that your first video was that your first video on YouTube, the one with the treadmill?
Well, that's the year YouTube started. So, yeah, it was the first video.
I guess it had to be.
Yeah. We had made plenty of major label videos before that, but that was the that's the year our homemade stuff started.
Why did you start doing homemade stuff?
Actually, let me correct myself. That wasn't the year our homemade stuff started. We've been making, Tim, the bassist, and I have known each other since we were 12 years old, and we've been making crazy stuff together the whole time. It's just that's the year that YouTube started, and there was somewhere for us to put that stuff.
Ah.
You know, Leo and I were talking a little bit before, just we're going to talk about EMI and all that's happening right now. But just to go back to that video and kind of your first submission to YouTube, I'm just curious because I've watched that video so many times in terms of the coordination. How long did it actually take you to put that together?
The treadmill video?
Yeah.
That took us about 10 days. We went to my sister's house in Orlando, Florida, where she was a professional ballroom dancer at the time, and so she had a dance space that we could use, and she choreographed the routine for us, and we practiced for it was about 7 days of practice, and we shot it for 2 or 3 days before we got it right.
Yeah, it looks like it took a lot of effort.
Yeah, I mean, but the Rube Goldberg machine, which we released,
that's amazing.
Ago, yeah, took a lot longer. That took about 6 months to make.
That one's truly incredible. Is that all one take, the Rube Goldberg?
We got to the end of the machine 3 times, and it was we intended for the video to be one take. As it turns out, we liked the camera work on different takes differently. So there's one part of the video that's edited in from a different take. But it is, I mean, the machine itself runs from beginning to end, and it's
so cool.
In spirit, it is one take, even though there is one edit in there.
It is incredible. I guess you keep upping. This is for the This Too Shall Pass, but you keep upping the ante. I don't know how you're going to continue to.
Well, we keep making stuff we like.
Yeah,
we've made plenty of videos in between that haven't done millions and millions and well, I guess all of them have been in the millions, but we haven't released another 50 million style video for a few years. But we in between we made a video with a marching band from Notre Dame,
right,
which I love, and we made one for a song called WTF, which is basically just us dancing with a video effect that I think is like I'm just as proud of that one as I am the Rube Goldberg machine. And we and of course we made an album which we are extremely proud of, the things that we make are we don't draw this sort of arbitrary distinction between like videos and our songs as if one is an advertisement for the other. The band's creative projects are basically all our babies. We get up in the morning animated by the desire to chase our ideas, and sometimes those are video and sometimes those are audio only, but they're all things that we get to make ourselves, and it's so much fun.
Did a light bulb go off though when you had that huge success on the first video?
Well, when the treadmill video did so incredibly well, I mean, light bulb is sort of the wrong metaphor for it. What it did was it allowed us to. It basically gave us the backstory to walk into meetings with people like major labels and say like, no, actually, the way we do things does work, fools. We've been fighting for years. Can you just, to do things the way we wanted to? I mean, it seems sort of evident to us that in a digital age, if you make something that's exciting to you, presumably there are other people out there who will also be excited by it. And, what the game, of course, for the money people is whether there are enough people to make that worth their while to invest in or something like that. But for us, we've never been a particularly good fit for the old world music industry because we don't particularly care about their metrics. I mean, how many records get sold doesn't matter to us. It's how many people are listening to our music and watching our videos, and how that works in a digital age. It has nothing to do with physical record sales necessarily. So when the treadmill video was that explosively popular, we were able to sort of see, like, you know, to not be the underdogs all the time and be like, no, really, listen to us. We'll make our videos our way. We don't want to make commercials for you. We want to make art projects, and they work.
So at what point did you sign with EMI? Was it before 2005, or did it happen because of that video?
Yeah, we signed with EMI in 2001, I think it was.
So you were already signed when Here We Go.
It's Here It Goes Again.
Here It Goes Again, yes.
It's signed for a long time at that point. Yeah. To be totally clear here, EMI did wonderful things for us for many parts of our career, and I have no beef with EMI. I think that the system is, you know, the system based on record sales is shrinking with record sales. I mean, it's sort of, you know, no brainer. Right. Like, if people stop buying records, then the companies that sell records are going to start shrinking. We had been doing the sort of normal major label promotion stuff for a few years. It's just never a particularly great fit for us because we much prefer to make our own stuff and do it our own way.
So what was kind of the breaking point for you? Even if it was a decision you both agreed on, why did you decide at that time to leave EMI just in the past couple of months?
It just seemed pretty clear that the ways in which we are succeeding and the things we're making don't necessarily fit into their system particularly well. And, they're a record company, they have to sell records, and that's the metric that they care about. Having a video watched, tens of millions of times doesn't necessarily sell an extra CD. Many people argue that, and I think it does sell extra CDs, but, that in their world, videos still have to be sort of advertisements for a physical product that they sell, or at least for a digital product that they sell. And it wasn't a good fit for us. That said, I have nothing bad to say about the label. It just wasn't, I think we'll do a better job on our own. And I think they recognized that, and it was a amicable parting of ways.
You wrote in January an op-ed piece in the Times that kind of, when I read it, it was like, okay, I guess it's over, because you were still with EMI at the time, but you said, you know, we get these great videos and stuff and they won't let us embed it.
Well, you know, I think disabling the embedding feature on videos is sort of like sending out CDs with scratches all over the back of them. I mean, there's like, you know, it so hamstrings your video, right, if it can't be blogged about. And I mean, you guys know that you would never intentionally try to direct traffic away from your own site. So the bloggers of the world aren't going to blog about stuff that can't be embedded right there on their site. And it's just, I mean, it's a fact. And there's all sorts of, I recently did a panel talk at South by Southwest with several people from YouTube and learned a lot about this. I mean, these were not things I knew when I wrote that op-ed, but they do, you know, very careful analysis of the numbers. Basically, things cannot, like, nothing can go quote unquote viral without being embeddable, because the first 2 days of something spread almost always happen entirely through aggregators. So if you're not able to be on an aggregator site, you just don't really exist, you know? I mean, after that, once it's word of mouth and people are saying, hey, have you seen that Rube Goldberg machine that OK Go made? Then they go to the YouTube site, right, and look it up. And late in a video's life, most of the traffic is actually on YouTube's site. But you don't have a prayer trying to get people to watch things if people can't blog about them.
Do you think that it's more difficult now to try to get up to, say, 50 million views because there aren't as many, you know, in 2005, there weren't as many videos online. There wasn't as much competition. Are you guys finding it more difficult now, or what do you think?
I don't really care. I have a lot of sort of nerdy math friends, and a lot of them were involved with the making of the Rube Goldberg machine. And there was a great deal of discussion about what they're trying to apply, like the scientific, you know, projection curves that they use for other, you know, other systems to see, like, they were trying to guess how long it would take to get to 10 million views or how many views it would have at the end of the such and such a date. And while I find that it's sort of academically interesting that my friends are, like, having so much fun with that, we make videos because we like making the videos. And it's only good news for us when they go global and everybody wants to see them. But the metrics of success for us are not like they don't come after the fact. They're our pride in making these things. So I, I, I guess I don't really. I mean, who knows? I wouldn't consider it trouble that anyone's having. I mean, things are different out there. You know, I think you get hits a lot faster than you used to because there are all these aggregators. And if you think about the web as sort of a machine that's building itself, it's learned to put a lot more oil on itself in the last 5 years. You know, when you when we put out a video of the treadmills, it took weeks before that would hit. You know, in France. It would be on, you know, somebody would blog about it in France 3 weeks after it came out, and you'd get 2 million more hits while all of France looked at it. Of course, with this video, the world sort of sees things simultaneously now, and things happen much faster. But it's not total numbers. It's like, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of people out there watching our videos, and that's pretty cool.
You make the point in the Times article that the record companies had a role. They were you call them risk aggregators. They made it possible for a lot of people to take a chance.
Yeah.
And what is do you think there's a role for record companies now, or should everybody go the route that OK Go is gone?
Well, OK Go has been lucky to, you know, we've had enough success that this is not a particularly scary move for us. We won't have trouble keeping our bills paid, I don't think.
Right.
Getting to that point is really difficult, though. And I mean, what I refer to as risk aggregation is basically this. Even among bands that have gotten to the level of getting signed by a major label, and as any young musician knows, that's a really high bar to set in the first place. Even people who have gotten there, success rates are about 5%. I mean, and by success, I mean people who wind up actually making money and not just sort of like, you know, getting to ride on it for a year and then getting kicked back to their job at Starbucks. So if you take that tiny slice of the world, you've only got a 5% success rate. Would you bet your money on that 5%? I mean, it's like you're going to lose. And for people to bet their own money on themselves means that they're going to wind up in debt after their band doesn't succeed. You know, and I mean, anybody with a head on their shoulders knows it's a long shot. And, you know, no matter how good you are of a musician, it's a long shot that you'll ever get paid for it. And so dumping, you know, the money into it that you should have been saving for grad school or that you should have been, you know, paying your rent with is stupid. And so what was nice about the system of major labels, despite the fact that they were, you know, they did all sorts of terrible things, is that they bet on lots of people at once, and they only needed one of those things to succeed because they took the lion's share of the profit and spread it out among all the things that failed. So they could sign 100, 200 bands a year and only need three of them to succeed, and then everybody walks away. I mean, all these kids, you know, got in the van, drove around the country a few times and gave it a good shot. And if they don't succeed, they don't have to pay back the label. They, you know, they got an advance for a few tens of thousands of dollars, maybe sometimes a few hundreds of thousands of dollars that let them make a record and let them go on tour and get promoted. And if it doesn't stick, they go back to their job at Starbucks without, you know, $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 of debt. And somebody needs to be doing some sort of risk aggregation like that, or else only rich kids are going to get to try out their band. You know, and do you really want, I mean, do you really want it like to require that you know, you have to have rich parents before you can be in a rock band? That'd be ridiculous.
Hope not. This kind of leads into a good question that we have from one of your fans on Twitter, Sherwin Rocks. He's asking if you have any suggestions for upcoming bands or artists on how to get to the point where they could quit their day job and really pursue a music career.
Well, I mean, this is going to sound incredibly pat, but the first thing is make awesome stuff. And I mean, if you have a lot of doubts about whether or not what you're making is any good, I mean, imagine how much more skeptical the rest of the world is going to be. And I think, no amount of good marketing and internet savvy or, you know, wise business moves is going to get crap to float. You know what I mean? It's just you've got to be making good stuff. And often good music and good videos and good everything still don't make it because, you know, marketing things get in the way and bad business decisions get in the way. But you can't, in this day and age at least, there's no one at the top sitting there being, you know, pushing a button and saying, and next, bing, Mariah Carey. You know, like nobody has that control over the system. So the surefire way for the cream to rise is make sure you are the cream. You know, and then after that, I mean, I'd say just, you know, careful of things that seem too good to be true. I mean, like, there, you are here, and the people who are listening to you are out there, and all, you know, you're connected to them by what our good friend from Mr. Alaska calls, I mean, good friend from Alaska calls a series of tubes, right? So everybody gets, you can connect with all your fans, and it's not hard to do that. The question is there something for them to like? I mean, mm-hmm. Does anybody want to be your fan?
Yeah, definitely. Hey, so this is just sort of a question from a friend of mine who works at a company called Silver Orange on the East Coast of Canada, and I think you might know him. But he was saying in your background, you were a programmer at one point, or you can program. So there's kind of a geeky side of you that maybe not everybody knows.
I studied computer science for about a year and a half in college before I decided that wasn't for me. I thought that I could do that and music at the same time, and then had to make a choice. And I chose the much riskier, the route that made more sense for my heart. But Andrew Ross, the guitarist in our band, is still actively a programmer. He actually does the back end for a site called Open Congress, which is a political transparency website, and it's
site. You know, that's a wonderful site,
isn't it? And that's all Andy's work. He did the back end for our site, and he does he does a lot of programming still. He mostly works in Ruby on Rails, and he's actually just learned how to code for iPads and iPhones. So there could be something in OKGo's future on in the iWorld. We'll see.
That's exciting. I have another question here from Bill Meeks. He's asking what the story is behind the song She's So Damn Hot, saying it's one of the most well-written songs of the past decade.
That's great.
It's You're So Damn Hot. And I wrote that. I mean, that was more than 10 years ago now, but I was in a period. We were living in Chicago, and we were, in a very tightly knit group of musicians who were mostly like aggressively sort of like avant. You know, most of the music was in weird time signatures, and having vocals in it was like a complete sellout. So everything had to be instrumental and had to be like, you know, post punk and post art and post everything. I mean, it had to be like post. And at some point I just sort of was like, you know what? I want a song that feels like Joan Jett. Like I want a song that where like the, like, it's just, it's like all about obviousness and pumping your fist and just gets under your skin and makes you feel bright for once. And I was like, well, what's the most obvious thing you want to say with a straight up pop song? And it's just like, damn, that girl's hot.
It's simple. It's a simple emotion, but it's all that people require.
It's just a straight up song of lust.
You guys do such a great job, and I think it's really telling that the cover of Billboard this week is about OKGo and the fact that you left EMI. It's the industry recognizing, yeah, there's something going on here.
Yeah, it was kind of the artist to actually leave that ship floating in the background there.
Oh, yeah, look.
I love that.
It's not sinking. It's steaming off in the distance. It could That's be a Titanic great. Shot, but it's not, yeah. The OKGo website is okgo.net. You can follow them on Facebook at facebook.com/OKGo. I'm a fan. And on Twitter. Who does the Twitter account, Damien? Do y'all do it, or...?
No, our friend Mike Rosenthal does it. We have two people who do our sort of internet. They're like our internet SWAT team, and we work so closely with them that they're basically part of the band. I mean, almost everything we do has something to do with our sort of digital life. I mean, I feel like it's where we live, it's where our fans live, and it's how we sort of exist as a band. But if we were actually doing the Twittering, we'd never even get to the gig.
Probably not. So what's next for you guys? I know you've formed your own label, and I'm sure you're working on many creative projects, and you just had your recent video release. What can fans expect in the next few months?
Well, a lot of shows. We're playing a ton of festivals this summer, and we've got a 7-week tour of the U.S. starting April 13th, I think it is, in Salt Lake City. Is it Salt Lake City 13th, you know? Salt Lake City on the 13th, and we go around the entire states in 7 weeks, and we'll be doing European festivals in the summer. We're doing Bonnaroo in the States. We're doing Sasquatch. We're doing, we're doing a whole bunch of festivals. Bamboozle. And we've got plenty more videos coming. We just filmed a new video last week, and we are doing some really interesting sort of uncategorizable projects with different designers. We're doing some things with furniture designers and fashion designers.
And you should really do a treadmill. Come on, guys.
Yeah,
you're missing a bet here. The official treadmill.
we on this upcoming tour, we will be fans can get the recording of the live show on a USB drive right there at the show.
Excellent.
Let's see, what else are we doing? I mean, our lives are incredibly busy right now, but there's a movie being made about the making of the Rube Goldberg machine.
Oh, that's
And we're making another video with my sister who did the treadmill choreography. We'll be shooting that in June and doing festivals in Japan and Australia, plenty of European festivals over the summer. So basically, aside from sleeping, we're doing everything.
Everything. I have to ask just because I'm based in Toronto in Canada. Any Canadian stops on the tour?
Yes, there's a Toronto date. Victoria, could you tell me when the Toronto date is? Sorry, my friend Victoria is going to look it up for me because
you have lots of fans in Toronto, so I have to ask anyone.
I love
listening.
Toronto. We've always had a really great time in Toronto, and it feels it's amazing how international it actually feels. I mean, you sort of feel like you're driving through the Midwest. It's the Midwest, and then it's like Toronto.
It's in the middle of the Midwest, and sold out, by the way, in Brooklyn, in Tokyo. You should go and get tickets immediately. Toronto is April 23rd at the Mod Club.
Oh, you got it. Hey. I was just going to say that. Yeah,
I'm looking on the website. It's all here.
Oh yeah,
well, I'll be
doing
there.
That. I'm staring into my camera.
Yeah, no, you can't do that. You have people. Victoria, she does that.
Victoria.
No, I think this is a great template for anybody who wants to do it on their own. And you know, we have many friends like Jonathan Colton and Umphrey's McGee who are doing it on their own. It's, I'm sure, very scary, and yet I'm sure it's very satisfying in the long run to have control and be able to embed your gosh darn videos.
Yeah, it is very satisfying. I mean, yeah. I think it's. People go into music largely because they don't want to go into business, and the downside to doing it yourself is you gotta understand the business a little bit, and you have to do a lot of business. But the upside is you have total creative control. You have total control of your distribution. You can deal with your fans the way you want to. You can make the things you want to and sell them the way you want to and give them away for free if you want to. And it makes it feel a lot more like art and a lot less like business.
You hit the nail on the head. I mean, I have the same issue. I don't want to be a businessman, but you kind of have to do it a little bit if you want control.
Yeah, and I think it's all a balance. I mean, the major labels certainly were very out of balance for a long time because they got to the point where they could make stars. You know, they what made it, it's funny, we get all these questions about like, are you worried that your videos are more important than your music? And it's like, well, tell me about the 80s or the 90s then. Like, when MTV is what made hits.
Right.
Because people were, those were all video bands, except the videos, I mean, the bands didn't make the videos, their labels did. And labels got a little cocky about it because they basically could, pour a certain amount of money into promotion, get a famous director to direct a video, and make a star. I mean, they could just push a button and out came success. And that stops being a distribution system between musicians and the people who want to listen to them. That starts being sort of a content generation thing. I mean, they're actually making culture then. And we're getting back to a position where musicians can actually directly connect with fans and with music listeners around the world, and with minimal interference from middlemen. The thing is, what was good about that system was all the business it achieved for people. They got they got too big for their britches. But I can imagine a pretty good system where there are people who are good at the business stuff, doing the business stuff, and allowing artists to be artists about it. So, I think for the time being, you kind of have to go it alone. But there are plenty of people out there trying to build new systems, which hopefully will allow musicians to not have to have an MBA to make it work. Mm-hmm.
But you do have to have the talent. You have to have the ability. And as you say, you got to create the content that will drive traffic. And you've certainly done that. Already 10 million views on the new video. That's amazing.
That's awesome.
Well done.
We'll keep you updated.
Thank you, Damien. Really great to talk to you. Damien Kolasiu is
the
lead singer and guitarist for OK Go. OKGo.net is the website. Now, are we allowed to play a little bit of your video on the show?
Yeah, you can play whatever you want.
EMI is not going to come suing us.
EMI, as of next week, I believe EMI's claims to that are all gone. I think the date of switchover is April 1st. Uh-oh, sorry.
Here comes the dog.
Yeah, my dogs love it when I talk about EMI.
they're on alert.
Yeah, no, we encourage you to play our video anywhere and everywhere and enjoy it all you can.
Well, let's play it right now. Thank you, Damon. Great to talk
to you.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Damon Kulash of but this is an amazing video. You just got to watch this. I don't know how they got this to work, Amber.
I don't know either.
Get the Bing ad out of there. It's great, though, because they're a very good band, you know, as well as talented videographers.
They're just so creative. I mean, that's what I love about all of their stuff.
Yeah. I think that's, in some ways, that's what this promotes, is the artist, multidimensional artist.
Yeah.
This is amazing, this machine.
I know, it's kind of mesmerizing watching that. For people who are listening along, you need to check out their video online.
It's on YouTube. 10 million views. It's 1080p available as well if you've got a high-def capable device. Look at that. Amber MacArthur, what a pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Yes, it was so much fun, Leo. And we have lots of guests. We have, I think, Ben from I Can Has Cheeseburger for next week. Is that, am I saying
Ben
Ha right?
From I Can Has, are you saying it right? Yes, Ben Ha from I Can Has Cheeseburger will join
it's
us.
It's hard to remember that one.
You can catch Amber at CommandN.tv. That's her video podcast. AmberMacArthur.com is her blog and website.
And of course, AmberMac.com.
I'm sorry, AmberMac.com. And of course, on CP24 during Web Nation in Canada, not the Midwest.
Nope.
We'll see you next time.
All right, thanks,
on
Leo.
Net at Night. Seem a little nervous. Oh! Jeez. Oh, no wonder they were scared. Oh, isn't that great? That's a Damien in the blue there.